Okay, today I'm on the Zoom call to Yoni Sidi. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us today. You're in Cyprus. So you're the Chief Marketing Officer and founder of Marketbox Media. Can you explain what your company does, please?
In essence, it's an operational and marketing service company for the world of gaming and Forex. It was launched 5 years ago, just utilizing mine and my partner's experience in the world of online gambling, which is relatively extensive. And it started just by small little brands coming to us asking for help, and it kind of evolved into several little brands, some medium brands, and then several medium brands. And it's been going for, it must be 5 or 6 years now.
Okay, but you, as you said, you've got a fair bit of experience and at the very top level. We'll go into that in a bit, but can we just, I was interested to read the information you sent me. Before finding success in the industry that you're in now, you were hoping to do it on the turf as a footballer. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it didn't last too long. I think I thought I was better than I was, but I've always been into sports, always played football, had a sports scholarship at quite a prestigious private school in North London that had a few people who went on to be professionals. I think Martin Chivers' son was one of them. And I got offered trials for a team in Israel. So I kind of left London. You know, I was never the most academic of children at the best of times. You know, I always just wanted to play football. So I left London at the age of 16 to pursue a dream. And it kind of evolved, and it was fun and it was great. And I played originally with a quite a high level in Israel for Maccabi Tel Aviv youth team, and then to Maccabi Herzliya, and then ended up playing third division Israel, which was not glamorous at all. And it kind of just fizzled out, and I needed to earn a real living.
Yeah, and to earn that real living, you decided to join the Israeli army. Now that is, you know, it's quite extreme by anybody's standards, isn't it?
That wasn't to earn a living. That was to stay in the country. I had to do it. My father's Israeli, so I had the choice to, if I wanted to stay in Israel, to do the army. And it's always been something that's quite appealing to me. You know, the discipline side. I didn't imagine it would be as tough as it was. And I think I was probably quite naive. But I suppose at that age, you kind of are. You just kind of do things and say, you know, what's the worst that can happen? So I joined in 2001 for a three-year service, mandatory service that everyone had to do. And it was a real shock at the beginning. You know, at first I was sure, you know, it'd be easy. I'll be shooting a few targets and sitting in an office somewhere. But there was extensive training, especially at the beginning, because I had to learn the language, because you know, obviously if you're in the army and they're after the language, and then turn around to you and say, no, watch out, he's behind you. You haven't got time to get out your dictionary and say, hold on. Everyone stop what you're doing. So the first couple of months were really hard because I was far, far away from home. No family, no friends. 300, 400 soldiers all in a camp learning the language and learning how to be a soldier. Not too many Brits around in those days. So that was really, really tough. But kind of got through it, and then it went on to be a combat instructor for some very, very good soldiers in a lovely base in the middle of the desert. But it was kind of the timing was a bit dodgy because it was the beginning of the Second Intifada. So there was always something going on, always some kind of action, you know, and I'm just a kid from London, you know, suddenly I see myself guarding, shooting, being shot at. So it was interesting. I made, you know, a lot of great friends and memories that it's difficult to even explain those memories. You know, when you're 17, 18, my friends are at university and drinking and having fun. And, you know, I'm sitting there at 4 a.m. in the freezing cold guarding some base or a checkpoint, whatever it may be, thinking, what am I doing here? But yeah, it definitely developed you into the person you are, or the person you can become. And it was, you know, one of the most amazing experiences of my life.
Okay, you've skipped a bit, haven't you? Hell Week. Can you tell us a bit about Hell Week?
Hell Week was So after the initial 3-month training program to learn Hebrew and learn how to become a soldier, I was then drafted in to become a combat instructor. And combat instructor is a very physical role. It's a 3-4 month process where you have to, it's a lot of actual studying, but a lot of physical training. And the last week of it is actually what we called it Hell Week. And it was just like you would see in the movies, out of nowhere, they woke us up. We were sleeping in tents. It was February. We're right on the beach, just by Netanya in Israel, freezing cold. I cannot tell you how cold it was in February, right by the beach. You know, we'd set we clothes on and we were hugging each other out of nowhere, 3 a.m, speakers blaring, music, everyone up. They get us up. We've got no idea what's going on. We don't know if we're being attacked. We don't know if we're being kicked out. We've got no idea. And they say, right, you've got 7 minutes to get dressed. Everyone gets dressed. Then you've got 3 minutes to get down to the next point. We get down to the next point, and there's these two huge, gigantic logs. They say, right, team A, you go to a log. Team B, you go to a log. Lift it up. You're carrying this log. And you walk down to the beach, down this really steep sand dune. You're on the beach carrying this log, walking up and down, into the water, out of the water, put the log down, dig under it, dig over it, into the water, out of the water. And you're thinking, how long can this go on for? It went on till at least midday. You know, we wanted to die. And so they said, right, now you've got the real test. The real test was then to go on some kind of run, hike in a certain time, then through the water again, up the sand dune, do an assault course. Shoot, hit the target 4 times. You don't hit the target 4 times out of 4. You've got to do it all again. We did it for a day, thinking, oh, you know, this is, thank God it's over. You know, not everyone passed and whatever. About 6-7 o'clock, we're thinking, okay, it's done now. We can get some food in us. And no. You're going down to the beach again. You know, where do we sleep? Where do we down to the beach? Get your logs. We had to sleep on these logs, lift them up again, carrying it. And it was like that for four days solid, just playing games with these logs in the water, out the water, sand everywhere, water everywhere, freezing cold. During the day, it was nice, but in the nighttime, freezing cold. We're standing in the water, holding these logs above our head for minutes. I mean, for us, it felt like hours, but minutes. Then up the sand dunes. I mean, it was just, and again, I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing here? Why am I here? I can just go back to England and I can go live with my mummy and daddy in North London and be fine. But again, once you look back at it, and once it's done and you pass it, you know, you've hit those 4 targets and you've done the assault course in the allotted time, and you've run the 2K in the allotted time after everything you've gone through, you look back and, you know, you laugh and you have a joke. You think, you know, your mind can do anything. And before I joined the army, I never would have thought that I could have put myself through that level of exertion. Even though, you know, I was quite sporty, I played football. It was just a different level. It was a mental as well as a physical test.
Okay, so when you left the army, you deserved what you got next. You worked in a beach bar. Is that right?
Yeah.
When you left the army?
Yeah. I had to find a job. I needed to earn money. Football wasn't going to be the way. So I started working at this, I would say trendy, but more sleazy beach bar in Tel Aviv. Where it was in quite a rough area, but it was one of those bars that's always the last one to be open. So, you know, when other bars shut at 1, 2, 3 a.m, all of the real night owls come to our bar and stay there till 6, 7 a.m. Obviously highly intoxicated, you know, not wanting to go home. But that was also an experience because, you know, I was just learning the language. I've always been quite a good salesman, even, you know, before I left to Israel, I was always working in the markets with my friend's dads, selling stuff. So I just looked at it as a sales opportunity. And I would, people would come in and I would try and gauge how much money they had on them and try and set them up with women or men or whatever and make sure that you got as much tips as possible. And I became quite good at it, you know, just selling drinks. And I think that was really a stepping stone to kind of the next phase of my life, which would be my professional life.
Yeah, so go on to tell us about that, about your first job in sales. That was in Better, in gaming?
Yeah, so what happened was I was managing the bar eventually for a period of time, and one of our local customers who was always good at giving tips came up to me, and he was a South African guy. He said, listen, you seem to be a very good salesman. You know, I really enjoy your company. Come work for me. I'll pay you much more than you're earning here and whatever. I explored it. I went to see him, and you know, he told me what he was doing wasn't totally legitimate and didn't really sit well on my conscience. It just put it there. But it kind of opened my eyes to the sales world and sales opportunity. So I just went to Google and said, you know, jobs for English speaking people in Israel. The thing that came up was a market internet company. So I thought, okay, it sounds quite good. They were looking for a head of UK sales. And I just thought to myself, that ticks my boxes totally. UK, I enjoy sales. I went to the interview, and the guy who interviewed me said, listen, I was 23 at the time, I think, 24. And he said, you're way too young. We need someone professional with experience. I said, trust me, I can sell, you know, whatever it is. He goes, oh, we're a casino company, but you're too young. I said, just give me a chance. I promise you I'll be good enough. He said, you know what? Because you seem like you're pushy, you can go and start to be a customer support representative. I was like, fine, you know, it was a job. It was actually probably less than I was earning in the bar. And it was shift work. I went into the first shift. And I saw a bunch of, or group of my future work colleagues all typing away on ICQ. For the viewers that will know what ICQ is. And I couldn't really concept that. But, you know, if we're selling things, why are we doing it over a keyboard? So I said, you know, let's start calling these people. And everyone's like, no, we don't really call people here. I said, you know, don't worry, let's speak to them, let's speak to our customers. So I started picking up the phone, speaking to these Americans, and they were loving the English sense of humor. Again, it was a very different day for online casinos back then. And straight away, after maybe a couple of weeks, I became VIP manager for two of the brands. And a funny story, so there, one of our VIP players, the two casinos were called New York Casino and USA Casino. And one of the VIPs was the wife of a very successful chief executive, one of the largest companies in America. I'll just give you her first name. It was Robbie. I won't go into second name details. Anyway, we built up a relationship. Whenever she was online, she would ask for me. I'd have to come into the office. I'd speak to her every time. Everything's okay. Give her comp, but she always wanted to speak to me. And this relationship grew for weeks and became quite intense. We got to the point where she asked to see pictures of me. Now I'm a salesman. My targets were based on how much she would spend. So I would send her pictures and she would send me pictures back. Until a few days in a row, she stopped playing. And suddenly I get an email. To my stage name then was Jerry. Jerry, my husband's found out that I've been speaking to you. I have to stop playing. He's taking away my credit card. I'm actually emailing you from an internet cafe. I'm like, I'm very sorry to hear. If anything I can do, please let me know. She goes, I want to come and meet you. Now, bear in mind, they all believe that our customer support team was based in Antigua and not in some smaller office in Tel Aviv. So I said to the boss of the company, I go, listen, she wants to meet me. She's a huge VIP, but she wants to meet me in Antigua. So he's like, okay, you better go to Antigua. And we had an office there for corporate reasons. And I was sent to Antigua. She was planning to come and see me the day after I got there. I had to get to know the place and know the people in the office. And they had to get to know me as if I'd been living there all my life. And literally the evening before we were meant to meet, she sent me an email saying, listen, my husband won't let me come. I'm very, very sorry. And that was it. But I got to see Antigua for a couple of days, which was brilliant.
It's a bit, we'll talk a bit more about VIP management in a bit, because obviously that's a bone of contention, at least in the UK. I'm just interested that you've been modest now, but you told at the job interview, you told them that you'd be head of marketing before you finish. Now, was that bravado or was that genuine self-belief?
A lot of it comes down to my sporting background. Well, I've never been the best, but I've always been a trier. And, you know, growing up, it's not like we wanted or we lacked anything, but we didn't come from, you know, money. You know, I can never have gone to private education without a scholarship, for example. So I've always kind of, aiming to stay, I'm competitive and try and like to try and prove people wrong. And the guy who was interviewing me was you know, a really kind of an obnoxious guy, and I could feel the tension straight away. And it just kind of made me want it even more. And even when I was VIP manager, he started arguing with the head of VIP managers to say, right, I want Yoni now. And it became like an argument in the office, and quite a big one, where the CEO had to get involved and say, listen, he needs to go to do marketing. And I did remind him of that time, and he was actually, you know, my boss for a good amount of years. I reminded him quite a lot as we became friendly that, you know, remember at the beginning you didn't want me, and you didn't think I had a chance. And, you know, at our peak, especially when America closed, the European market and especially the UK market, this was in 2006, became predominant for us. Because, you know, we were 90% a USA facing business. So within 24 hours, we had to change the whole focus of our business to start targeting Europe, Asia. And again, it's not how it is today. We're talking about 13 years ago. You know, it was still very desktop based. There was no mobile. A lot of it was done on email and ICQ. The conferences were much smaller. They were held in dining rooms, not in huge exhibition centers. So obviously the markets evolved, but there was always, you know, I would always work harder and longer than anyone else, especially because I really wanted to prove my boss, who was French, which didn't help matters, prove him wrong. And in the end, you know, it was a huge success, and you know, the company did very well from it, and I, you know, built a decent career out of it as well.
Okay, now you went on to become the VIP manager, as you've already told us with the story. And that's one of the parts of the industry that's under real scrutiny in the UK in a minute at the moment. Can you sort of explain the role and the types of people that might become VIPs?
So, again, I think it's important to state that back then is not how it is now, in terms of the regulation and the Gambling Commission, the restrictions that companies have. And the ability to interact with potential VIPs is extremely limited to compare what it was back then. In then, there was no regulation. The sole purpose was to get as much money as possible. And you would look for patterns or trends in their betting or in their deposits. You look at the methods they use to deposit, whether it be credit cards or more sophisticated methods. You know, if they had online wallets back then, you would know that they are more experienced to spending money online. You know, if they didn't get declined from their banks. And our aim and our role was to A, keep them with us as long as possible, and B, to increase their bet sizes. You know, if their bet sizes on average were $50 or $20 a spin or $100 on roulette or blackjack, you would say to them, and you know, I see that you're having a good time, blah, blah. Here, have another 100 or have 200 and put it on for me. And you kind of get them into the habit of spending more money, and you've kind of given them 200, which is complimentary, but they think, hey, you know what, I'll stick with the 200. And you've already doubled your revenue. And the payout's the same payout, so that the house will win eventually. So it's kind of twofold. You're looking for the trends to try and spot them early. And once you get them, you want to try and keep them as long as possible and try and increase them. And you do that through VIP levels, for example. You know, at the moment, you're VIP 9. To get to VIP 10, you just need to spend this amount each month. And VIP 10 will get you, I don't know, vouchers for a spa or whatever it may be.
Okay. So then by the age of 24, you're managing all of Europe, apart from France, and yeah. You relocate to London, and you've got like a driver and a cook. I mean, at 24, was that quite, and I assume there's a few quid rolling in as well. I mean, was that quite hard to keep your feet on the ground?
So the CEO came to me one day, and again, the business back then was booming, and it was much easier than it was. And the UK was always kind of seen as the golden goose at that time. You know, like the Gambling Commission and Gambling Act hadn't yet been enforced. It was a bit of the unknown, but you had big brands there making big money, public limited companies. My boss came to me literally one day and said, right, you know, how do you fancy opening up an office in London? I was like, sure, you know, I'm English. It's easy for me. Get back to see my family, my friends. I'd love it. He said, right, what do you need? I said, just give me a place to stay, an office, and we'll see how it goes. And I said, you know, what's the purpose? And he goes, don't worry. Just go there. You'll understand the purpose. You know, again, similar to how I moved to Israel, I was kind of, what have I got to lose? Let's go for it. flew on a private jet for the first time, my first journey over. Had no idea where I was going to. From what I understood, I was staying in a hotel for the first couple of nights, but picked up by a driver. I was with my CEO, picked up by a driver who took me to a place in central London on Hyde Park Corner. Stunning building. I look up, I'm like, you know, what is this? Stunning, beautiful, grade one listed building. I walk in, you know, the driver opens a door out to a Phantom, Bentley Phantom, opens a door, which opens the other way. I get out and there's people inside the building just standing. I'm like, hi, everyone. And, hi, I'm Mika, I'm your cleaner. Hi, I forgot the names, but I'm the doorman. Hi, I'm Thingy, I'm your cook. I'm like, you know, what's going on here? And I look inside this building, and it's magnificent, you know, big white staircases with red carpet and huge ceilings. As you would expect for a grade one listed building overlooking Buckingham Palace. And Mika, I'll always remember Mika, she came and showed me to my room, and it was, I thought it was a room, it was a two-bedroom flat with fully furnished, and for my bedroom it was overlooking Buckingham Palace Gardens. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have a great time here. You know, I turn to my boss and go, what's going on? He goes, all this is yours. You know, you're going to open up a company, open up a site, a gambling site, it was actually a bingo site back then, that then came a casino, and he goes, I want you to buy the whole internet. I want you to make sure that everyone knows who you are, and buy every single player you can. I was like, okay, fine, that sounds easy. So I set up the office, you know, with very little experience, but it kind of evolved, and we started bringing in players and bringing in traffic, and I was having a good time, you know, wining and dining all the clients, all the affiliates, and kind of got my name out there. But still people would come to the office and be in shock, you know, you're a 24-year-old kid. What is this? What is going on? Are you a drug dealer? You know, how have you come to this situation? And again, it was another part of my life that was taught me a lot about myself. Because again, I never would have thought that I could go through with that process and build something that would be a relative success. And you know, have meetings and have a work ethic that would be work nonstop. And it was fantastic. And, you know, it's a story that it will live with me forever, to have all of that in my fingertips, and to build a business and to build my reputation in the UK, was magnificent. And it just had a great time with affiliates, with clients, and become friends. You know, some of my closest friends now, people that I met back then, people have gone on to be a success. And it's, you know, it really is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that I grasped with both hands.
Okay, now you were part of the Playtech William Hill merger. What way were you involved with that?
So because I was buying the whole internet, and the name kind of got out there of who we were and who was our backer. One day, someone from William Hill contacted us and asked to do a marketing deal for us to help them with marketing. They came to our office, we met with them, and I phoned my boss. I go, listen, William Hill are here. You know, I'm not quite sure how they've ended up here, but there's a chance that we could help them with marketing. And it was kind of then when the penny dropped, my boss kind of said, your job is done, leave it to us. And that's how the discussion started to come about between some very high powered people at Playtech and some very high people and skillful people at William Hill. And at the time it was the largest joint venture in gambling. Obviously it's been dwarfed by the likes of Flutter and all the others. But back then it was groundbreaking. It was taking a predominant retail business online. We were working under the stewardship of Ralph Topping, who was a phenomenal CEO with great tradition, great history, great foresight to drive the business to basically, I mean, when we met him, he wanted to overtake Ladbrokes, but we did that and more. And it was a groundbreaking deal trying to merge not only two companies, but two different cultures, which was difficult. But yeah, that was the first stone.
And you made some groundbreaking deals with the likes of The Sun and The Racing Post and Odds Checker, you mentioned to me. In what way were they groundbreaking at the time?
It was our mentality. We were online marketeers. We always tried to have a monetary value to every click, impression, everything that we believe that could be judged for whether it be the how much it's costing you for that user, how much revenue you're making. And back then, that model wasn't really in place with some of the larger brands, some of the larger media owners, where they were happy taking flat fees just to be there. And we tried to incorporate the idea that, you know, they can become a partner in the revenues that were being generated from the players. You know, someone like the Racing Post is one of the largest affiliates, or was at the time. And we had to try and integrate that mentality or that mindset that you can actually earn in more than just a flat fee. And if you're a partner or you have an invested interest in this deal succeeding, you will then go above and beyond into give us best positions or first opportunities. And it didn't work for everyone, but with some people it did, and it was a great success. Even, you know, Oddschecker back then, it wasn't the Oddschecker today owned by Sky. You know, it was an affiliate, pure and simple. Two guys working out of a very small office in South London, I believe it was. So again, I come back to the difference in culture, where we brought our mentality, our marketing mentality that we've evolved in the dot-com market for the past 4 or 5 years, and brought it to these large media owners. And we had a lot of successful partnerships with the likes of The Sun when we sponsored the Dream Team, or ITV when we sponsored the South African World Cup, The Racing Post, Oddschecker, JC Deco, magazines, other newspapers. You know, we worked with a lot of them.
Okay, so it all went a bit peak Tong in 2007 when there was the walkout. Can you just briefly tell us how that panned out?
So there was always a conflict of interest between what was good for the retail side of the business and William Hill. They were a 70-odd%, and the Playtech side of the business, which was just part of the online. And I think it just, you know, the people at the top just kind of came to a disagreement about where budget should be spent. And I think it just kind of spiraled out of control. And we were, in essence, in the middle. I mean, there were seven of us. We were the key employees. And we were kind of just following orders. You know, we were Playtech people. Our bonuses were based on online performance. And as much as we enjoyed working with the PLC guys and the retail guys, and we did some great, great work, I just think eventually both companies did very, very well out of it. The walkout, I believe, was very unfortunate. And, you know, in hindsight, probably should have been handled differently from both sides. Again, it was an experience. It's something that we all learned from. And both companies did very, very well from it eventually when William Hill bought Playtech's stake from the company. You know, and I've since seen a lot of the guys at William Hill, and the relationship is still good. You know, with the likes of the CEO at the time, Henry Birch, and Ralph. But it was a very another interesting period that you think to yourself, you know, how are you in this situation? You know, you were you've gone from trying to play football to in the army, working in a bar, being a typing on ICQ, going to Antigua, and suddenly you're you know, you're part of what was at the time you know, a real scandal. But it all did get resolved. We sadly had to leave the company, me and the six other key employees. We had to leave, which meant that we forfeited a lot personally to walk away from the company. But it was what it was, and everyone went on to do other things and succeed. And, you know, when you look back at it, you do kind of laugh.
Okay, so we talked about the William Hill walkout in the last part. So the seven of you, I assume the seven of you originally started with Winner.com, and you started a bingo advert.
So we were basically, we had an earnout for a period of 6 months, so we couldn't do anything in gaming. And we were a very close-knit team, all highly skilled in their own way. And we're sitting there, and all of our expertise is in gambling. You know, none of us has got an idea. And we literally said, right, let's all go out and try and find a business and try and find an angle and come back. But we, you know, we just always came back to the same. We got ourselves a nice little office, and we just sat there just talking every day about gambling. you know, we tried to do something with remote computer fixing, something with pharmaceuticals, and something in America, and we always just came back to the same concept, which is our DNA, which is online gambling. So we spent 6 months having a good time, but doing absolutely nothing. But we were always together. You know, we rented supercars and went car racing. We went on trips. We went to conferences. We met people. We had lunches and dinners, and it was a relaxing time. But we still were itching to get back into the fold. And then when the earnout ended, we got hold of the domain winner.com, which was a great domain. And we believed that we could, you know, do it again. We were all hungry. We were all young. We'd learned a lot. So we took our marketing expertise. We targeted the UK. And, you know, it was a good success. It was a good domain name. We had a casino product, a sports product, and a bingo product. And you mentioned about the TV advert. So we decided to put the brand on TV, something that we learned a lot of and about through the William Hill days, you know, where we were spending millions with the, you know, on all of the products. So we decided to shoot a bingo advert. So we went through the pitch process and used a great agency. And I always like to be there for the filming of the adverts. And I'm there in Manchester at 5-6 in the morning, took the train up. I stayed overnight, took the train up, stayed in the hotel, went to the shoot. I'm in the caravan, enjoying the biscuits and the teas, and speaking to the director and seeing the actors get their makeup on. The director goes, "Listen, how about we stick you in the advert?" What am I going to do? He goes, "Oh, we'll find you a role." Anyway, the costume guy comes in, puts a fake cast on my leg, and goes, "Right, you're going to sit at the bus stop while the woman's dancing. Just look, you know, look like you're a bit confused," which is very easy for me. And that was it. I had a role in the advert, which is my claim to fame. And the winner bingo did very, very well. I don't know if it's because of my cameo role in the advert that inspired people to play winner bingo. But we took a good domain name that was generating nothing to over $10 million in deposits a month. And it was, again, a really enjoyable time to build a business from scratch and see it succeed and have fun doing it. And I think that's really been an important factor for everything that I've done personally, to be able to enjoy it, whether it be the army or the football or the bar work or speaking to Ruby and other VIP clients and marketing. I enjoy meeting people and I enjoy closing deals and seeing results. But most of all, it's always got to be an enjoyable environment, and that's something that we've always had, always tried to have, and to this day, it's something that I always make sure that, you know, my guys are able to know how to enjoy themselves.
Is that where the tie-up with West Ham came in?
Yeah. So I met my now wife when I relocated to London. Actually, my first week, thinking I'm going to live the bachelor life, and my first week, my friend sets me up with my now wife. So I enjoyed my life in a different way that I would have thought, perhaps, living in central London with a driver and everything. But her parents are big West Ham fans. And West Ham were looking for a betting partner. So I said, you know, let's do it. We also, again, we tried to implement the idea of them taking a more active role in driving us users by giving us better positions and stuff like that. And we had the sponsorship of the billboards, the electronic boards. But something that I closed, which was quite clever at the time, that, you know, on minute 45 and on minute 90, it's just us showing. So if there's a minute of injury time or 5 minutes of injury time or whatever. And part of the deal was that we also got a box. And now I'm a Spurs fan. I've got no interest in going to, it was Upton Park back then. I've got no interest in going to Upton Park every week, but my in-laws were obviously over the moon. So they were going every week to the games, sitting in the box. So my in-laws were basically entertaining my clients, because I had no interest whatsoever to go to West Ham on a bi-weekly basis. And after the games, my father would call me and go, "Oh, you know, so-and-so was ever so pleasant, and I didn't realize he was such a big gambler, or he apparently this one's an affiliate, and suddenly, you know, I have an accountant father-in-law who knows what an affiliate is, or knows what a punter is. And I think the first game we had, West Ham played Liverpool, and I decided to go to the first game just to go with them and show them the box and everything. And Sacco was playing for Liverpool, and he went down with a head injury at the time in the first half, and he was down for ages. And I'm thinking in my head, stay down as long as possible, obviously hoping it's not serious. And he must have stayed down for 7 minutes. And anyway, we had 7 minutes of LED exposure in the first half. The game was televised live on Sky. And you know, my boss is calling me from Israel thinking, you know, this is genius. Everyone's like calling me. We can see winner for 7 minutes. You know, it cost a lot of money to buy that type of exposure. So I'm always grateful for Sacco for getting a knock on the head.
No, but fast forward, you started your own agency, Market Box Media. Now, why did you decide to go on your own?
I suppose as a group, we've been together for near enough a decade, and we've done a lot. We've all grown, you know, we've all seen each other get married and have kids, and evolve as business people and human beings. And just opportunities were always coming about, and just felt like we had something else to try and prove, and to get away and try and do something on my own rather than just be dependent on, you know, it's always good to have someone else to fall back on. And the six of us were great together. But I just wanted to try and do it with myself and one of the other guys who joined me. But they were still a huge part of the success of the agency at the beginning. Throwing deals our way, working together on certain deals. But it was just more of a feeling of, you know, I want to try and do something by myself. And, you know, there was no animosity. It was all good. And we're still very close today. But it was just an urge inside me just to try and steer a ship myself and not just be, you know, one of the six or one of the seven. That just basically was just an urge.
Okay, so you've been successful at everything you've done. What's the difference between a good and a bad marketing agency? Obviously, you know what a good one is.
I like to think I know what a good one is. And listen, you're based on results. And something I've always found, there's many ways to skin a cat in marketing. And it's not always what you know, what you knew. There's lots of ways to get from point A to point B. And that's something that we found over the years. The good thing about marketing, especially digital marketing, which was you know, our main area of expertise, yes, we've done a lot of offline, a lot of TV, radio, sponsorship campaigns and what have you. But digital, it's very easy to track and to monitor. You know, every click, and I go back to the point that we tried to relay this or bring this into the William Hill joint venture at the time, that every click has a purpose, every impression, every eyeball has a purpose. And there's a way to measure it. Today, for sure, you can measure it, you know, with great sophistication and target your audience to much greater detail than you could back then. But I think you have to be very open-minded and understand if a campaign doesn't work, it doesn't mean that it's never going to work. It could be you need to change the offer, the creative, the position, the size of a banner, the language on the banner, the offer. It could be that the user is going through to where you want him to go through, but doesn't go through to deposit or to play. And then you may have to change what you're showing them on the landing page. The amount of stuff you can do is endless, but you have to be able to A, have the patience to try everything, because there's no reason why certain things shouldn't work, but you also have to have you have to be able to take your blinkers off and not say that, you know, if I'm a marketing agency, I'm only going to focus on Google PPC, but why not focus on affiliates? Why not focus on native adverts? Why not focus on pop-unders, pop-ups, email campaigns, anything? And I think that's probably what I would say would make the difference between a good and a bad marketing company, agency, or campaign.
Okay, now life is about to become a lot trickier for you guys, by the looks of it. That three of the things that you've mentioned several times have become in sort of dirty words, VIP schemes, affiliates, and online casinos. Now, how are you sort of worried about that?
I'm not worried. For one of the main reasons that I believe in the UK, it's extremely difficult to succeed unless you're one of the big, big brands and you have very, very big budgets. The world is big. The world is huge. There's lots of emerging markets. There's lots of exciting things happening in Latin America, in America, in Asia, in certain countries in Europe where regulations are happening and less strict. Back in the day, we did a lot of things, stuff that you could not do today. You couldn't even utter those words in a conversation today without being tarnished as irresponsible or not putting enough attention to GAM care and what have you. The UK is a very difficult market. I understand why they're taking these steps. The UK is the leading market in the world, in my opinion, and has been for years. And it's leading the way in regulation, again, in my opinion. But when you say they're dirty words, the fact that I can't say those words now, and the fact that you have to be so careful and tread on eggshells, perhaps rightly so. Again, I believe what the Gambling Commission are doing is good, but I think they're going about it the wrong way. And I think, they are maybe being overprotective and not looking at the right people, because gambling is something that's not going to go away. It needs to be correctly regulated and correctly managed. But, it's in our tradition, it's in our DNA, and it's been with us for a long time, and it will continue to be with us. And I think you have to make sure you're looking for the right people and targeting the right people when it comes to the regulation. So in my opinion, the UK is just, it's too tough unless you have big budgets or you're one of the big brands.
Okay, so we ended the last part talking about, the regulations in the UK and what looked to be, any going to be stricter. A lot of the bookmakers are worried that they're getting lumped in with, people that have lost money sort of lying on the sofa half drunk, playing on their phone, online casinos and stuff. I mean, have you ever had any of your customers that have complained that they've had to restrict or ban a player that was too good for them?
So yes, we've had to be very careful, and I won't go into names, but some of the marketing activity that when we used to work more in the UK, a lot of that would come with a lot of compliance checks, loopholes, seminars, and what have you. And that's what, these things also take time to train my staff on what they can and can't do. Is time consuming, and that time perhaps could be spent in other markets where they could be generating revenues for my company. So yes, when we do work with a company, we make sure we're fully compliant in the UK for sure, and other regions. But we deal in every market. Even Germany now has been hit with huge regulations, and Holland closed on us earlier this year. So we work globally, and like I said, the world is a big, big place, and there's enough emerging business, emerging markets out there for us to focus on and not take any risk or unnecessary risk because maybe we're not as savvy as we should be on the compliance changes that are constantly happening in the UK.
Okay, but back to my original thing. Is there such a thing as a customer of an online casino that is too good for the online casino and that needs to be restricted? Or no, is there any way, anybody that beats it?
So yes, we actually had an instance, funnily enough, that you brought up this question. We actually had an instance of one of our clients, one of their customers, won over £200,000 or euros, sorry, wasn't in the UK, By finding a loophole. We found a loophole in a jackpot that we were pushing. We're not in control of the jackpot or the payout, but basically it was giving him points and spins when he shouldn't have been getting it, and he won. Now, did this guy do it on purpose? Did he know? We think he did. We think he was looking for us. But there are players that will get restricted in the world of online casino, just like they are in sportsbook. You know, there are people that we don't want. There are people that are trying to use systems. There are people that will not have a long-time value for the brands that we're representing. They are easier to find today than they were back in the day, just with the tools that these brands have. But there are definitely people who believe and who have beaten the casino, and they will get restricted and you know, they're not wanted by most of our clients.
I'm quite sure that several people are cheering out loud now to think that at least some people do beat the casinos. But I'm guessing that as a general, there'd be a very, very small percentage. So would it be right in saying that the two most important parts of an online casino is acquisition and retention of players? Because ultimately, if they keep playing, you're going to get their money.
It's a very, very simple game. And if it was complicated, then I doubt that I would have been doing it for near on 20 years. You have to acquire the user for a certain amount, and you have to make sure that you earn from that user more than that certain amount that you acquired him for. There are certain users that are more expensive to acquire because they come from certain media channels, media owners like Google, where you have to make sure that you convert them very quickly because your every click is costing you money. But then because it's been so expensive to get him, you want to make sure that you get the most out of him or her, whoever it may be. Now in the UK, it's much more difficult nowadays because of source of funds, KYC, people can lock their accounts and you can't target them again. And that's a big risk and a big burden to hold on the marketing team, on the marketing budget, to make sure that everything is working correctly. So retention is important, but how much retention can you actually do today in the UK? You're extremely restricted in the interactions that you can have with the user.
Okay, so you're predominantly a marketer, but what would you say is the difference operationally between a well-run and a poorly run online casino?
There's lots out there. There's lots that are white labels, so they have a shared environment. So perhaps you don't get the personal touch that a larger brand that's managing all of their services themselves in terms of the operation side, the CRM and the VIP, which I think makes a big, big difference. But you know, the big firms, the big guys out there do it very, very good. And they are, from what I see and the people I'm working with, they're extremely well run in terms of the operational side of the business. Maybe not always on the marketing side, but in terms of the operational side. But I think having your own standalone environment for your own product, and having a good product as well, a good mobile product, a good web product is very, very important.
Okay. One of the things that, you know, being sort of a bit older, when the last thing that I can imagine anybody being prepared to do when the internet first became popular was stick their credit card in there and trust that they're not going to be totally tucked up by an online gambling, even bookmakers to begin with. So, I mean, was that pivotal in your success that worked out that people were suddenly starting to trust it?
Yes. So at the beginning, you know, we used to get a lot of declines. I'm talking about when I was back in my ICQ days, because it was a new phenomenon, you know, to put your money into the computer was, you know, it was new back in 2004, 2005, 2003, 2004. So when you had those declines, you always had an answer. You know, if you can't use credit card, maybe use Neteller or Skrill or some other online money bookers or whatever it may have been back in the day. And, you know, God, I'm nearly 40, but I feel like this conversation is, we're talking about black and white days. Where today, you know, I think people are much more savvy. You know, they're using their credit card on a daily basis online anyway. So, and the younger generation, I don't believe have that fear and have that difficulty that people used to have over a decade ago.
Okay, so here's the question. How do you feel morally about online casinos? I mean, you know, when you get somebody, you're nice to them, they join a VIP scheme, you know that you're going to get their money ultimately. I mean, how do you feel about that? Is it something that keeps you awake at night? You wake up with a cold sweat, you're a bit worried about karma. I mean, how does it sit with you?
It's a very good question. I feel like I'm on a chat show now where I'm about to cry. And I had this conversation the other day actually with a journalist. Funnily enough, obviously he wasn't writing a book or anything, but you know, just asked about it. I think the best way to sum it up is how I feel about morally. I never really told my grandmother what I did for a living. So, you know, I can look at myself as an internet marketeerer. But in essence, my role is to get people to part with their hard-earned cash for gambling. Gambling should be done in moderation, like anything, you know, like alcohol, like booze, like tobacco. If it's in moderation, then I think it's fine. It's very sad when you hear stories, and there have been stories, especially in my professional career, people who have lost everything, and even more tragic than that. And that's why I'm all for the steps. I'm all for taking steps in the right direction to try and help those people and find them earlier. But I'm not for disrupting our industry too much where it affects the livelihoods of the thousands of people that work in the industry, a lot of good people. But I would definitely say morally, there is something there that's disturbing. When I look back at what we used to do in the past, I think nowadays a lot of protections are there for the user. And again, rightly so. But back in the day where we kind of knew no better, and it was a bit more cowboy and Indian, you know, we were intrusive in our marketing activities. And stuff that you cannot do nowadays, and stuff that I would not do nowadays, because you know I do believe that it's on the wrong side of the moral compass.
Okay. A while back, a few years ago, online poker was a thing, which sort of seen its peak and appears to be on the dwindle. Do you feel that online casinos? I know you say it's a big wide world and there's always new markets, but do you feel that online casinos, at least in the European sort of arena, could have seen their day as well if these new regulations were certain to come in?
It's definitely becoming harder, and I think the market is becoming extremely consolidated, where you're seeing that the smaller fish are just dropping out the ocean because they can't compete for the marketing wise, and it's just not worth them trying to, with all of the issues, you know, one fine from the ASA or from the Gambling Commission, and you can lose your license. And you cease trading, and it's happened. You know, brands have had their license taken away. Some of the smaller ones, some of the big firms have had big fines bestowed upon them. It's becoming harder. It will never go away. There will always be gambling. There's been gambling since caveman times. It's been going on, and same with tobacco, and same with booze. The regulations will continue to become stricter, but at the end of the day, it's an industry that provides a lot of money in taxes to the government. It provides a lot of jobs to a lot of people. But it's becoming really, really, really difficult. But I can't ever see it going away. You know, as technology evolves as well, and payment processing becomes even easier, it won't go away.
So you as a company, but can you see would you be versatile enough as marketers just to flip industries if you felt the need? Is that something that you even envisage ever having to do?
Well, we have. We have, because I believe it was the time. The world is big. We've started dealing now with Forex and Forex companies, dating, Nutra. You know, we are in our world and have been for a long time, but there's lots of things going on and lots of business to be done in terms of the world of digital and online, especially in with the skill sets that we've learned dealing with online casinos that we believe will give us a fighting chance working in other verticals. So yes, I'm all for diversity, and like I said, we've done it. But for us, the biggest diversity was focusing on other markets, like the US, which is a great market, Latin America, where we helped launch one of the largest brands in Mexico. I believe there is where the next frontier is for us personally.
Okay, so you don't fancy investing your hard-earned in bricks and mortar and buying a proper casino or something like that?
Definitely not. I speak to Ben enough and understand how hard the retail business is, and how many headaches. Again, you know, being part of William Hill, I actually went to work in a shop in Wood Green for a week. It's not a casino, but it's tough when you're dealing with people face to face. No, keep me behind the screen, please, and a keyboard.
Okay, so for the final question, Yoni, what is next? You're looking at those emerging markets. You're still forging ahead with gambling.
Yes, don't tell my grandmother still. It's what we know. It's what I've done. It's what I believe to be relatively good at. They say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. You know, as much as we've evolved through the times when it comes to marketing, I see the US, which was a great market for us back in the day, you know, with huge potential and more states opening up. Latin America is a huge, huge continent with huge potential. And it's kind of it's a beautiful emerging market because they've kind of skipped the web phase and they're straight into the mobile phase. Similar to Africa, you know, we had a project in Nigeria. We're now having discussions with another company, Ethiopia. The world is huge. And, you know, if you're prepared to work and travel and meet people, which is stuff that, you know, I personally love to do, then that's where I believe that our focus will be.
Excellent. Well, on that note, Yoni Sidi, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Simon.
Download the Star Sports app from the App Store or Google Play. All of the Star Sports markets, including in-play, all easily accessible from your phone or tablet. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.